I mean, technically, yes, we have a few MLS guys, but not really.
Yeah.
Okay. NFL. I probably shouldn't drink out of this. That's going to be allowed.
No, it's fine.
We like, it's like part of the ambiance. We're going
Yeah. It's okay.
Beautiful. And
occasionally there's a beer that opens. And...
Welcome to the Fieldwork Podcast, a show where continuing legal education is delivered through conversations about law and business. This episode, our host, Gavin Johnson, will be interviewing Colin Roberts on the various aspects of sports law. Colin is an NFL sports agent and a former practicing attorney. So from the attic in Tangletown, this is the Fieldwork.
Before diving into some of the substantive topics, I'd love to hear, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear as well, about your transition from a full-time practicing attorney to a full-time sports agent.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me on. I like to say former, I should say recovering. I think that's a better term.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yep.
I guess I do practice a little bit here and there for my clients. But I can discuss kind of, how I got into it. My intention going into law school all along was to be a sports agent. And so for those of you who don't know, the way you kind of jump into this business, there's a couple different routes. One is to seek out more or less an unpaid internship at one of the larger firms. And those would be in my field, kind of a CAA is probably the most well-known, or an Athletes First. Or you kind of go the route I did, which was on my own and seek out and try to get clients by yourself without a big agency behind you. And when doing that, you're not getting paid. So I obviously needed to make a living and practice law. And I kind of knew that all along. And I was fortunate to meet these guys at Invigor and work at a really cool firm that had this nice, healthy balance of practicing law, but also enjoying life. And so for about 4.5 years, I practiced law as a business attorney. And then nights and weekends, I built my agent practice. And eventually got to the point 2-3 years ago where I could do it full time and support myself and my family.
Awesome. And I left out of your title Professor Roberts. I know you have taught courses in sports law at Seattle University. I don't know if that's something you're still doing, but I know formerly you were Professor Roberts, so occasionally I'll refer to you as that tonight. I wanted to touch briefly on just kind of some basic background in sports law, and wanted to start off with discussing, and we'll focus primarily on NFL. I know that's where you focus your practice right now as a sports agent, so I think we'll stick with that. If we touch on some other sports, great, but we'll stick with NFL. And I wanted to discuss briefly the relationship between leagues, owners, athletes, agents. I think that's something that is not entirely clear from the outside world, and something that I think, you know, if you're practicing sports law, it's probably something that you want to have a pretty good handle of.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, I should have told you this before, but I think even before jumping into the specifics of leagues and unions, sports law as a whole is interesting because sports law is not an area of law, right? Sports law is a bunch of areas of laws of law that touch the sports industry in some capacity. So saying you're a sports attorney isn't really a thing. Typically, you're an employment attorney, or you're a criminal attorney, or you're a contract attorney that work with people in the sports world, right? So when we go through some of these topics, again, think that there's not very many people that actually do that are quote-unquote a sports lawyer. It's usually people that are subject matter experts in a specific area of law who happen to work with a player or with a league or a team. So,
right. Do you, I mean, while we're on that topic, we might as well dive into that a little bit. Is there one specific area? You touched on a couple areas, practice areas that are within the sports law realm. What are the maybe one or two practice areas that within sports law or as a sports agent that you see come up most frequently?
Yeah. So for me, contracts, primarily number one. So my primary job would be to draft and review contracts. Although really I don't draft contracts. They're, you know, the NFL contracts are standard boilerplate contracts. There is some edits to them that happen, some drafting, but more or less we're negotiating over numbers than we are specific contract language. There is a little bit of that with guarantees and things like that, but I'm not drafting contracts from scratch. So I'd say that's the first area. I think probably second area that I deal with the most is a lot of my clients have off-the-field endeavors, so I'm either setting up business entities for those off-the-field endeavors or filing trademarks for t-shirt lines, sports drink lines, all sorts of different things that they're interested
in, whatever
it may be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I do a decent amount of kind of contract and intellectual property law, I guess I would say.
Cool. Yeah, and I know you mentioned briefly labor law. I'm curious, and I think this kind of dives back into what I was talking about with the relationship between leagues, owners, athletes, agents. I think we dive into a lot of union issues, yep, labor law issues. So let's jump into that. What describe briefly that relationship between these different players that are usually involved?
Yeah, well, and it's a poignant topic considering, you know, as of today, we found out that President Trump was not allowing the Eagles to come to the White House, and it's, you know, goes to this dispute that the NFL has had all year with the players.
Right.
So it's actually very timely. The players, the NFL is a organization that is made up of 32 different teams, but they are not a single entity, and that's, I won't dive too deep into that, but that is a heavily litigated topic that in, I think, 2010, the NFL finally lost on the single entity argument. Basically, they were trying to avoid antitrust laws. When you are those 30, if the courts had ruled that the 32 teams were one single entity, then they would never have to worry about antitrust issues because it's just one of them. The court did not rule in their favor in that regard, but they still more or less get to operate how they wanted to. So the NFL has 32 teams, 32 owners. Those owners then, well, the NFL generates revenue, and then the owners and the players split that revenue up. And more or less 50-50.
Are they nonprofits? Are these teams nonprofit organizations?
The NFL actually technically is a nonprofit. I won't get into that too much either, because the NFL, not too much money actually runs through them specifically. The revenues are distributed to the teams. Organizations are for-profit organizations, yes. So there's the NFL, and they have the commissioner, who's hired by the league owners. And then on the other side of the table would be the players union. So the NFL Players Association is the union that governs the players. And, you know, and with that, there's benefits, right? It's just the athletes in the union, the NFL Players Union, are just like any other union, a Boeing union or other employees that basically pool themselves together to help them from a bargaining, position. Yeah.
So then they every once in a while, and you could probably weigh in on this, how frequently this is, but they will negotiate a collective bargaining agreement, right?
Yep.
And that's going to govern what a lot of what they can and can't do within the union, what between the league and the union, what happens, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the collective bargaining agreement is kind of what it sounds like. It's a collectively bargained agreement between the NFL and the NFL Players Association. And that is like many other contracts, really. If you were a business attorney and you tell your clients, when I was a business attorney, we'd always talk to our clients that were setting up an LLC or a corporation, make sure you get everything in writing, whether that's in bylaws or in your operating agreement, so that the specifics of this relationship and this business and contract are spelled out. And so that's exactly what it does. It's the collective bargaining agreement spells out how much of revenue each party is getting, what's considered revenue. It dives into things like health and safety of the players, so limiting practice time, things like that. There's tons of discussion in it about benefits, so pensions and 401ks.
How many practices they can have when they have their helmets on and they're just smashing each other's brains out.
Yep, exactly. Which was drastically limited in this last one. That was a big point of contention. Yep. The other really interesting point of contention, and it's in the news a lot, is how much power the commissioner has. And one of the things the players clearly lost on is the commissioner has pretty much all of the power.
Right.
So all of that is spelled out in the collective bargaining.
The jury, the judge, and the executioner.
Exactly. Right. And it's, I think, I actually had to look at it recently because we have to take an, we have to actually take an exam this week, funny enough.
Well, thanks for taking the time out from all of your studying.
Yeah, tons of studying. I haven't studied this much since the bar. Actually, I haven't really studied that much. It's not that hard. But the collective bargaining agreement is, I think it's like 365 pages.
I was just going to ask that. It's how long is this
document? Yeah, it's long.
Yeah,
there's a
page
lot.
Page for every day.
Yeah.
Perfect. Hey everyone, this is Gavin.
And Kyle.
From the Fieldwork Podcast. Keep listening, and we'll share the code you'll need to get your CLE credits.
And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your preferred podcast platform.
Awesome. And how often is this negotiated? Is it on like a time table where it's negotiated every several years, or is it just when some big topic comes up for negotiation? Both?
Yeah, good question. It typically is on a specific time period. So this last one was agreed to in 2011. It expires in 2020.
Okay, so the collective bargaining agreement is going to have a term to it. Okay.
It will have a term, yeah. And then that's when you usually hear about at around 2020, we're going to have some issues, like potentially a strike, right? Mm-hmm. If no one can agree on, you know, on the terms of the next one. And there's already been discussion about that happening, so.
Yep. All right. So switching gears a little bit here. So specific to sports agents, there's governing laws, I know at the state level, here in Washington, there's an RCW that governs sports agents here in Washington, what you can and can't do, your interaction with athletes, how you enter into contracts with those athletes. Is that each state has its own rules regarding sports agents?
So each each state has, not every state does.
Okay.
The RCW, though, is the Uniform Athletes Agent Act, which was a model act put together by Congress, saying this is what we think laws governing athlete agents should look like, and then states had the ability to basically adopt those types of that rule, and states have slightly modified them to their specifics, but I think last I checked, it was like 43 states have adopted.
So this started at the federal level, and then states could adopt this uniform rule and then tweak it a little bit.
Yes, but it's not a federal law. Okay. So it's just adopted state by state. Before this, there was no model act. There were it was a piecemeal of legislation out there in different states, and someone decided let's have something that looks somewhat uniform. So it looks in a sense like it's almost a federal law, but there's not actually one. It just depends on the state you're in.
Is there a governing agency beyond the state legislation that's passing these rules? Is there any sort of governing agency above that? So like a federal governing agency, or are you just looking like each league specifically is essentially your governing
agency? So there's not a federal agency. It's just each league. Okay. And that's primarily who I really have to think about and deal with, is the Players Association governs agents. They tell us how much we can charge. They tell us when we can contact players. All of that stuff is more or less governed by them. But then I also additionally have to deal with each state and their Uniform Athlete Agent Act. And typically what's really a pain in my side, frankly, is that I am supposed to register in each state where I'm thinking about, or when I'm going to contact a student athlete. So even if I haven't signed the player, if I just want to reach out to them and give them a phone call, I'm supposed to have registered with the state, paid their fee, which range anywhere from $50 to $1,000.
Right, and we know how long it takes to register with state agencies.
Yes, and in my experience, most of them don't even know exactly what's going on, the people within the states. This is still relatively new to them, and there's not very many of us agents out there, so this isn't a frequently applied for registration. But
got it. I'm curious because this brings up some of the questions that I'm going to dive into here. I'll start with this. How often are you, or how often are sports agencies working with attorneys to interpret these laws or these rules that are governing sports agents?
Not often. Typically, the agent is an attorney as well, and so they kind of take that role on. But some of the larger agencies have in-house legal counsel. I guess at a smaller agency like mine, I am the in-house legal counsel. So is that what you're getting totally. At there?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. I'm the reason I asked is I'm curious. So we're talking about sports agents. I want to make sure it's clear. We're talking about sports law. We're talking about sports agents and the intersection between these rules that are governing sports agents and the laws that are governing or the advice that lawyers are giving to sports agents.
Yep.
And what that role is like. And I think it's a unique industry and one that is interesting to talk about, like you said, because it touches on all sorts of practice areas. But then it's also something where usually the agent is also the attorney.
Yeah.
And so you're playing this dual role, but you're essentially representing yourself most of the time.
Correct. And really most, well, there, it depends, but there's a handful of agents, or there's, I guess I'd say there's a decent amount of agents that still practice day to day, but those are also, you know, it's agents that typically don't have enough clientele yet that they can, you know, leave whatever practice they're doing. So they're still practicing law part-time and then, you know, tracking down athletes and the rest of the time. But most that do this full time don't practice law other than they may give advice to their clients on certain topics. So again, I do stuff, you know, with contracts. If a client's buying a house or leasing a property, I review those contracts. That's actually probably one of the things I do the most. I didn't think of this earlier, is break leases, because clients are moving all the time, you know, so I have to break leases constantly. So I do legal work for my guys if it's in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
You know, I recently had a client get a couple speeding tickets, two within a week.
Not your thing.
Yes, not my thing. And there's attorneys that do that for cheap, and they're good at it. So
all right.
No need for me to do that part.
Yeah, cool.
Hey, everyone. This is Kyle.
And Gavin.
From the Fieldwork Podcast. This is your reminder that you can get CLE credits just for listening.
After this episode, go to yourfieldguide.com to receive your CLE credits.
To convince those in charge that you actually listen, you'll need this secret code.
Jerry Maguire.
Wait, what was that? I didn't catch it.
Jerry Maguire.
Okay, got it. Jerry Maguire. And now back to the show.
So I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about something that hopefully you don't have to deal with too often, but I know probably comes up in the context of maybe the collective bargaining agreements we talked about before, contracts. You talked about having to break leases. I'm sure this is something that at least could come up in those situations, but this idea of arbitration, and specifically this baseball style arbitration. The reason I want to talk about it is it's a style of arbitration that I think is becoming more and more used. It's something that I know in my practice, I see happening more and more often. It's something that we usually are discussing with clients as something that we see as a benefit to clients. So talk to me a little bit, kind of explain what is baseball style arbitration?
Yeah, I love baseball style arbitration. I think it's fascinating. I would wholeheartedly agree with using it in your legal practice. It's a beautiful way of getting two parties to be somewhat reasonable and compromise.
In a situation where most people aren't terribly reasonable or want to compromise at all.
Who's ever willing to compromise in fights? It's rare. Right. So yes.
Especially over money. Right?
Yeah, never. I love it. Interestingly enough, if I can give a little bit of history on baseball style arbitration.
Let's dive in.
In baseball, for most of the history of baseball, there was not this concept of free agency, and so players, when they were on a team, could not negotiate with any other team, and so their options were, if they didn't like the contract that they got from the team, it was either asked to be traded or released, and that wouldn't always happen. And so they were really, their hands were tied. They just had to accept what the team gave them, because free agency hadn't applied. That if you were on the New York Yankees, you were on the New York Yankees, and you couldn't do anything about it. And then at some point, a player said, "This is ridiculous," sued the league, won, and they. But part of the compromise was this idea of arbitration. So teams realized that free agency is what creates market value and what drives up prices and salaries. And so the owners decided, okay, let's have this middle ground of arbitration. And basically how it works in baseball is once a player has been in the league for 3 years it doesn't have to be with a specific team, but once they've been in the league for 3 years, they hit what's called arbitration. And when between years 3 and 6, they submit their name, or the team gives them basically a contract offer to be part of arbitration. I won't dive too much into the detail of that, but what happens is they go to the negotiating table with the team and they say, "I think I'm worth X, let's call it $3 million." And the team says, "No, I think you're worth $2 million." And after I think they each get an hour to state their cases, arbitrator chooses which one he thinks is more reasonable. The beauty of that is going into it, the team and the player knows what the other person's offer is. And so if I go into a negotiation and I realize that I really think a player is only worth $2 million, but the other side thinks he's worth $5 million, and that I've got a chance of losing and having to pay a player another $3 million, all of a sudden I think to myself, well, maybe this fight's not worth it. Maybe we should strike a deal in the middle, you know, at $3.5 million. And it's shown time and time again that as to be a very successful way of getting players and teams to compromise before ever actually having to go to arbitration.
Right, and if two parties are coming to the table knowing that one of their offers is going to be chosen, both are going to, at least in theory, both are going to come with reasonable choices.
Exactly.
Because the more reasonable offer is going to be picked,
yep.
Right,
yep,
by the arbitrator. So yep. If the more reasonable one, then you're both incentivized to bring reasonable offers. And I agree with you. I mean, I think it's something that in practice I wish was more widely adopted.
Yep.
And I think we're continuing to see more widely adopted. But that is a fascinating history and not one that I knew all the details of. Yeah. So thanks.
Well, the other interesting thing too, I think that's helpful for it, is in baseball style arbitration, they give you a framework to work within. So when you argue your case in front of the arbitrator, you only have, I think it's 6 topics that, or 6 categories of things that you can argue over. So it's things like players, you know, awards and honors from last year. It's comparable players, but only comparable players that had the exact amount of time in the league as this player did, and it's wins and losses from the teams they're on. So everyone has a very objective framework that they're working within, and so it requires you to be pretty objective. And it's, you know, with the rise of analytics, it's been pretty easy for the most part for players and teams to figure out more or less what they're worth. They're pretty close for the most part. And so it really, it's a very efficient process for getting deals done.
Is this something in your practice in the NFL world that you're seeing anywhere in contracts, or something that you're pushing for in contracts, or is it still just completely, everything's pretty much forms and you're not able to push for stuff like this?
No. And the thing is too, you know, I think arbitration's great. If I could, you know, so in the NFL, free agency doesn't happen until after year 4. So if I could get arbitration to happen after year 2 or 3, great. But actually, as an agent, I want free agency to start as soon as possible, because when I've got 32 teams bidding on my clients as opposed to one team, prices are driven way up. So I would rather there not be any arbitration and free agency happens as quickly as possible. But this was kind of the happy medium for, you know, the baseball world. I don't know if it'll ever get adopted into football or not. I would guess no, probably, just because they've been doing it this way for so long, but we'll see.
What about other contracts you're seeing? So outside of just player contracts with teams, other contracts you're seeing, you know, contracts related to marketing, related to other advertising deals, that sort of thing. Are you seeing this anywhere? Is this something that you push for, or this style of arbitration?
No, because frankly, most lawyers are lazy and they take the forms they've been given from the past and they continue to use them. And so I still see the same stuff. It's horrible legal language that no one understands, and or, you know, they reference I mean, some of them do reference doing, you know, some sort of arbitration or mediation. No one's being very creative with it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's no one's very forward thinking on this.
Yeah. I mean, the incentives with baseball style arbitration aren't typically, you know, you're not incentivizing the attorney to be able to bill a lot of hours, right? I mean, yep. I mean, the idea is that it's a more streamlined process. You keep costs down, yep. at least in theory, and you can resolve the situation in a quicker way. So it's not surprising. But yeah, I mean, I guess we just hope then the contracts that you're dealing with, you don't end up in a dispute.
Yeah, gosh, I hope not. Fingers crossed. I haven't yet.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll happen at some point.
We touched on a bunch of different practice areas. We touched on a bunch of different topics, both sports agent related, law related, legal related. What are some different, for those of our listeners that are interested in getting into this sports law, this thing that we say is not a practice area, but I think is it's sort of like an industry within the legal profession. What are some resources for attorneys that are interested in learning more or staying up to date on what's going on within, air quotes, sports law?
Yeah. I always tell people where I learn all of my information is on Twitter, and I think that's probably a blessing and a curse. I spend way too much time looking at Twitter, but there's so much information in the sports world. That is where most of it is distributed, and especially in real time. And so there's some phenomenal resources that I would just give you Twitter handles for to follow these people, because anytime if you hear about a player getting arrested, if you hear about, you know, Deflategate happening, if you hear about, you know, Trump telling the Eagles they can't come to the White House.
Or the next strike or the holdout.
Exactly. You know, usually there's one of these quote-unquote sports law experts that has discussed it on Twitter and then probably written something in more of a long form on their blog. And so the guy that I think is the best is a guy named Michael McCann. And you can find him at McCann Sports Law, McCann Sports Law. Yes, that's him. And I think he's technically employed by Sports Illustrated. Okay. So anytime anything sports related, yeah, comes out. Yeah, you've heard of that. Yeah, they're kind of a big deal. Anything though that comes out in the sports world that touches on law at all, he's on top of it, and he does a phenomenal job of breaking down all of the issues involved. He actually taught, interestingly enough, an entire course at a law school on Deflategate. For those of you who don't know, that was the controversy over
the New England Patriots
deflating, you know, footballs. And there's a wide variety of interesting legal issues in that case, and it went through so many different levels of courts and arbitrations that
it's like an entire civil procedure course.
It is. It's right? Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so he taught an entire course about it. So that's actually fascinating. So Michael McCann is one. There's another guy named Darren Heitner, at Darren Heitner. Darren and then Heitner. He puts himself out as a sports lawyer. And again, what that means is he does a lot of intellectual property. I know that he has actually helped specifically with agents in certain cases where they are either suing clients or clients are suing them. And then I know he does some work with kind of estate and family law issues that also touch on athletes. So he's a good resource. He writes for a few different publications, so I would check him out. And then the last one I think that's interesting is a guy named Andrew Brandt. Brandt is his last name. He was a former sports agent who then went to the other side of the table, worked for the Green Bay Packers as their kind of head negotiator and salary cap guy. And now he teaches sports law and business courses and then writes for a variety of publications as well on the topics.
So. Awesome. Awesome. So that's a ton of helpful resources. I'm curious, talking about resources, tips for attorneys that are interested in this space, how important is it for you having a background in law in being a sports agent?
I think it's an add value for my clients, but I don't think it's necessary. And again, I touched on this a little bit earlier, but you know, I spent a lot more time drafting contracts, drafting and reviewing contracts than I do now. That's a very small part of my job. I would say probably 80% of my job right now is just recruiting athletes. So it's a small part of the job, from a legal standpoint, but it's also a really nice add value. When my client needs to break a lease, I can help them break a lease. When they want to start a t-shirt company, I can set up their LLC. I can file trademarks for them. If they want to start a restaurant, which I advise none of them to do because they usually lose their money on it. But
But
I'm hedging risk for them. So I'll set up a business entity for that restaurant because athletes have targets on their back. And so having an attorney that's been trained to mitigate risk, I think, is a value add. But I don't want people to think that you have to be an attorney to be a sports agent, because you don't. There's plenty of very successful ones that weren't. And know what you're good at. If you're good at recruiting, if you're good at recruiting and negotiating deals, but not good with the details of contracts and all the other, you know, legal issues I pointed out, then hire an attorney to do that stuff.
So for those of our listeners out there that are attorneys, which is probably most, you have a leg up on the competition when it comes to becoming a sports agent, right? You've got that value add for your clients.
Yeah, I think so. Sure.
Great. So I want to go, we've just got a little bit of time left here, and I wanted to go a little bit of a different direction. It's something we do every episode, and it's a question we like to ask. What's the one thing, when you were practicing full-time as an attorney, what's the one thing you couldn't do without? Maybe on a daily basis, a weekly basis, the thing that was most important to your practice, something for our listeners that could be something they could check out, but what's that one thing that you know, you latched onto as a full-time attorney that you couldn't do without?
Well, I think it goes for both when I was an attorney and now as an agent, and it's a little bit different system, but it's a CRM system, so a customer relationship management. Is that what that stands for? Is that right?
Yeah. Close enough.
Yeah. Software that I use one now called Contactually, but in any business, staying present and on top of and meeting deadlines is so key. And what I, you know, so much of my job right now is recruiting athletes, and I talk to the athlete and I talk to parents, and so a CRM program is vital to me because it depends on kind of which person I'm trying to contact, but every 30 days I get a ping on my CRM that says, reach out to so-and-so's dad. And by staying on top of people and also fulfilling my promise to them that I'd keep in touch is hugely important, whether that's, being an agent or, you know, being an attorney.
You're maintaining credibility.
Yeah, and just really, it's really good customer service, yeah. Frankly. And jotting notes down in your CRM about the conversation that you had with them last time and asking them about their kids, you know, or their latest, you know, vacation or round of golf. If you write those things down, people think like, you know, this person really cares about me and they remember what we talked about. And so it doesn't matter what you do. I think, you know, a valuable resource for anyone is just a good CRM program.
Yeah. So Colin's tip to basically building relationships, right?
Yep. Exactly. And totally unrelated, but read How to Win Friends and Influence People. I think it's one of the best books of all time about, I guess the gist of it is like have really good emotional intelligence and how to be a person that people want to be around and that people want to do business with.
Here's a great story, because you and I go back quite a ways. This is a book that you recommended to me when we used to work together.
Yeah.
And I had a copy. I don't know if I still have your copy of it, but I had a copy that was your copy
that
you've had for a long time. It was a super old version of it. Maybe you got it from someone that was
bunch of highlights and
totally.
Notes in it.
Annotated all over the place. Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome. So another just quick question, and we'll wrap up here. But I'm curious, anything you've read recently that's super interesting? Could be anything.
Yeah. Well, Everybody Always is a book by a mentor of mine named Bob Goff. Love it. It's just about loving people really well. I think it's fascinating. I listen to a ton of podcasts. I've got a 1.5-year-old, so I don't read quite as much as I should. So if on I'll give one for the sports related stuff. Andrew Brandt, who I mentioned earlier, also does a podcast called like The Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt. And there's some really good interviews on there with agents, with GMs of teams. So he gets a wide variety of interviewees on there that I think are really good.
We should contact him about advertising on our podcast.
Bam. There you go. I like that. Yep. That's a good idea. And then, I don't know, I'm kind of a junkie on the, I'm just going to call them serial podcasts. I don't know what else to call those. So if you're into if you're into podcasts like Serial, I'd listen to my most recent one is Dirty John and S-Town.
Awesome. Thanks. Well, thanks for joining us. That's all the time we have tonight. Colin, thank you very much for joining us. I think that was an awesome conversation about sports law, sports agencies, the NFL.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Yeah.